and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. This is episode 507. I'm the co-host Mark Ames, coming to you from the greater Rochester area in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warner. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher. How you doing, John?
I'm okay. I saw the photo of your cat, the killer cat,
yeah,
that you sent because we had to reschedule because you had to take the parrot to the vet after having a nice little ice pick hole picked in its skull.
The lion did not lie down with the lamb. The lion stalked. It was, our Loven with the O through it, with the Norwegian O. He's gotten very big since he was a little kitty. And we do have three parrots now. It keeps growing. And he snuck into my wife's office and, ice picked basically the parrot's neck. Yep. And this is the parrot that thinks cats are actually pretty cool because she's ridden one of our cats. And because our older cats didn't care about the birds. But the kittens are different. The programming is fresh. And they have all these, it's like, you know, an X-Men or a Marvel comics, you got all these weapons, you want to use them.
Yeah.
So, one of those claws.
I see these YouTube videos with people who have their pet leopards, and it's like,
yes,
okay.
I know.
I'll just wait for the big headline.
I know. There's this, I was watching for a while, this Russian family somewhere in the west of Russia that had a cougar. They kept it. The cougar, it acted like a dog, but it's like a pit bull plus. Like, you never know when that thing's going to turn on you. So Loven got the bird. And thanks to somebody in Buffalo, actually, we found a place close by enough that would take the bird. And he didn't, Loven's claw did not get an artery or a vein or the crop. Mm. And so it looks like the bird's going to survive. They're so fragile.
That's amazing. Birds can't take much.
No. I mean, if it was the wild, it would have been dead because Gosha, the bird, she fell. She just fell to the floor after, and there was blood everywhere. It was very bloody. We thought she was dead and that was it. It was real luck that she didn't. She didn't die, and I think she's going to make it. But anyway, from the animal world, which we love, to the world of human wars, which you like a little less, but it's our world. let's get to a great interview we have with John Lechner, who's just put out a book on a very topical subject, the Wagner Group, and Yevgeny Prigozhin, and it's just amazing material. So let's get right to our interview. Okay, we are really honored to have with us today writer and researcher John Lechner. John is the author of an amazing new book that just came out. The book is called Death is Our Business, Russian Mercenaries and the New Era of Private Warfare. It's just came out through Bloomsbury Books. And it is... it's about the Wagner Group, the infamous Wagner Group, and but it's about more than that too. It's about the world that Wagner and Yevgeny Prigozhin came from, and the world that they interact with, and that he dies in. And so it's also just a great kind of book of our current time. So first of all, John, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And also, congratulations on a really great book. I mean, you've done a lot of reporting and traveling in the Sahel. In fact, I think that's how, because friend of the show, James Pogue, who was on the show last summer, I think he also he'd given a shout out to you on the episode we did with him.
And then,
gave me a heads up when your book was coming out. So thanks for that. So let's start. Actually, before we do that, I want to start with this. The first time I kind of remember coming across you in media, social media, I think there was something involving Wagner. But what stuck with me is that you put out a textbook on Introduction to Weinach, to the Chechen language.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked at it, but big like tip of the hat, salute to you. Like, how did you learn Chechen? And from what I understand, it's a really difficult language that is not connected to any of the major the major languages we know in Europe, from Europe.
Yeah, I like that. We're going to turn this into a linguistics podcast now. That's yeah. what that's yes. that's the
language,
dream right there.
Language
yeah.
nerds.
Yeah. yeah. I think you can see a little bit in the book, the Wagner book as well, that I think the main my main intellectual interest, my true passion, I think, is actually has always been languages, linguistics, language learning, and everything else is sort of a vehicle for me to be able to study what to me are these incredibly interesting languages that, like you said, can be, very different from what predominantly Europeans and people in the West speak Indo-European languages. And so I was always also fascinated in the Caucasus because, like you mentioned, this is one of the areas of incredible linguistic diversity. It's it's not a massive geographic area, but it's a very high mountain range. And there are three indigenous languages, language families spoken there, which are all unrelated to each other and outside language families. And one of them includes Chechen, the Northeast Caucasian languages. Then you have Circassian in the north with the Northwest Caucasian languages, and then Georgian and related languages, Kartvelian. And so I was always fascinated by it. And when I got to college, I read a biography of a Chechen surgeon who operated on both Russian and Chechen Russian soldiers and Chechen rebels during the two wars, and eventually he had to escape with his family to America, and it just so happened that he was living outside of Boston, where I was going to college, and I somehow came into contact, and his wife agreed to teach me Chechen, and it's always been a dream of mine to kind of create a textbook and make some of these languages more accessible. So, Mark, I'm gonna send you the book, and then
okay,
we have Beginner Circassian coming out next year, so wow.
Am I going to get quizzed?
Yeah, we're going to sign you up for the subscriber. Yeah, for the book a month thing. Yeah,
right.
Well, yeah. All I remember about Circassian is a line in Lawrence of Arabia where the Lawrence is captured and they think he doesn't look very Arab, which him being Peter O'Toole is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah,
and they say Circassian maybe.
Well, yeah, and there's this long, fascinating history of the Circassians who, there was a genocide during Russian colonial expansion in the 19th century, and massive population exchanges on each side. And so plenty more Circassians live outside of the Caucasus, and many moved to the Ottoman Empire and are found throughout the Middle East. And in some cases, they form kind of special military guards, presidential guards in Jordan, for example. They have a fascinating history too.
Yeah, yeah. And then, and we'll get into this anyway, you also speak Russian, Turkish, and Sango, which would be very useful for you, especially, seems like you spend a lot of time in Central African Republic. That's where Sango is spoken, right?
Yeah, that's the lingua franca in the Central African Republic. And like you said, I think that's where I probably have spent the most time. I think it's probably, one of my favorite sections of the book because the country itself is very near and dear to me. I first started reporting from the Central African Republic, where we'll talk about how Wagner, Russian PMC, had touched down there about a year earlier in 2018, and I spent a lot of time over the course of 5 years working in the Central African Republic, covering the conflict, covering Wagner, And, you know, one of the great things for me was that I had an opportunity to try and learn and speak Sango as well. Mm,
that's great. That's great. I mean, just having lived overseas for a while, I came across a lot of journalists who never bothered learning the local languages, let's say Russian, you know, usually in the case, and other ones. And it makes a huge difference when you do get to know the language. So let's get to our subject, which is Wagner, collapsed on itself and its owner was killed. But that Wagner loomed so large in the Western imagination, the Western media imagination for many years. And the story is, it's an incredible story. You knew it was an incredible story from everything. You know, we've talked about it on the show, but when you go through the whole narrative arc, as you do, of where Prigozhin and even Utkin, where they came from, and I mean, Prigozhin actually is a far more interesting character, I think, and how they navigate these worlds. It's a great, great story. So let's start with Yevgeny Prigozhin, the infamous, you know, bald-headed, shaven-headed, leader, founder of the Wagner Group, or co-founder anyway, or director. It all gets murky, of the Wagner Group, but certainly the face of the Wagner Group. Let's talk about where he comes from, what his background was, and then take it from there.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there are times, sometimes I think, you know, when you write and cover something, you become a little bit desensitized to it. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things about the book coming out is you become a little bit almost reacquainted with the story for what it is. And I mean, you're right. This is a guy who, I think, in many ways intentionally kind of lived his life according to like a Hollywood script. I mean, there is something very Shakespearean about him as a character, at least on the outside. But what I hope comes across through this book is that you can't tell the story of Wagner and how it ended up in all the places that it did and doing all the things that it did without understanding, first of all, the agency that individuals have, even in a system such as Putin's Russia, especially if they're framing their ambition and their desire for profit kind of within the bounds of furthering the Russian state interests and Putin's rule. And Yevgeny Prigozhin himself is someone who, you know, kind of he grows up, as we would say, kind of on the wrong side of the tracks. He's as a teenager, he's a street thug, kind of petty thief. He goes away to prison for sentenced for about 9 years, and when he comes out, the Soviet Union is collapsing, and he returns to his native, what is now St. Petersburg and no longer Leningrad, and quickly falls in with kind of a number of gangsters who, you know, were quite prevalent in Russia's very chaotic 1990s. And they set him up first as a manager of a grocery store business. And eventually he leverages that to starting two restaurants in St. Petersburg, fancy restaurants that very much cater to Russia's nouveau riche. And you know, the menu is just, you know, the most expensive caviar, champagne, you know, all things imported. And it's frequented very much by the Russian elite, including a younger Vladimir Putin at the time.
And who was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. And Prigozhin is someone who is endlessly ambitious. I think, you know, he's also someone who is clearly like a chip on his shoulder and very much looking to kind of overcome his lot, you know, that was allotted to him in life, which was to not be a member of the buttoned up elite. And, you know, he's an ex-con. There's a significant stigma attached to that in Russia. I mean, we're not going to pretend like it's easy for, you know, ex-cons in the United States to go out and get jobs as well. But he has there's a lot that he considers the others looking down on him for, and so he's always looking to overcome his status. He is always looking to meet the next most important person. He's the consummate networker, and so he, you know, he utilizes these contacts that he's making in the restaurant business to eventually getting the approval from Putin himself to provide or gets the contract to provide meals to the Russian military and schools. And kind of within the political economy of Putin's Russia, this is where you make serious money because you have the ability to extract rents and skim off the top from the state budget.
Yeah, that's moving from the local restaurant business to much more the big leagues. Although, as you said, and you describe it well, I mean, he clearly does have a chip on his shoulder throughout, because he will never, no matter what, he doesn't have the manners or something. He doesn't have
the background. Yeah, is his Russian different when he makes speeches or writes memos to be sent back to the Russian public? Does he adopt a more colloquial tone than insiders would?
It's a good question. I think he, it cuts both ways. He can turn it on and off, right? Like, I think a lot of, like, you know, a lot of people who are, have, I think, incredible people skills or like emotional IQ. And so we'll get into it later on. He certainly turns it on when he's recruiting from Russian prisons, because he himself is an ex-con. He speaks that language. He uses the slang. He probably turns it on a little bit when he's around Putin too, because that, in a way, is what makes him sort of distinct and attractive to Putin, is that he is uncouth and, you know, curses and things. And you know, compared to some of the buttoned-up bureaucrats around Putin, that might be, you know, a little bit refreshing or something that you know, Putin kind of delights in, right?
Yeah.
So I think he knew how to engage with different people, and so what's interesting how you bring that up is that it was both a disadvantage to him, but also an advantage in other ways, right? Because it made him, it allowed him to position himself as sort of the guy who would do anything and
absolutely. If you've ever hung out with a sort of middle class dinner party, it's someone announces a background like that, and like the first instinct is like, are you going to hurt me?
and then
if they aren't going to hurt you, then it's like, tell me some stories.
Yeah, there's kind of a fascination immediately, right? And sort of a deference as well, right? That this guy has seen things or something. Yeah,
he's authentic. Sure. Yeah,
he's authentic. Yeah, exactly.
Although I'll give him that, he's pretty authentic in a lot of ways. And
he lived his truth, as we say. Yeah, for sure.
So he, I guess at this point, before we go forward with Prigozhin, can we talk a little bit about the PMC, the private military contractor, the mercenary industry, such as it was in Russia, why there was or wasn't, you know, an industry, and what came before Wagner? And then maybe we can even talk a little bit about Dmitry Utkin, but first let's talk about like where the industry was before he got into it.
Yeah. And I make an effort always, I mean, with everything in the book, but to always put Wagner within the context of the environment in which it is operating in, and what makes it distinct or not mm-hmm. distinct. And so, you know, we can't talk about Wagner without also considering the where it fits in within the global trend.
Yes.
Towards the privatization of warfare.
Yeah. Well, I kept. I mean, I know you mentioned Eric Prince a few times, but I kept mentally comparing yes. Prince to Prigozhin, and every time it was to Prigozhin's advantage. I mean, this product of the streets claws his way up to something very close to the center of power, and meanwhile, Prince gets born into this clique of billionaires from a weird right-wing enclave, Holland, and then he goes to Hillsdale College, and then he just surfs. He buys God knows how many acres in Virginia, I think, and they never tell you how he does so, but he asks his sister, Betsy DeVos or something, like, hey, can you front me a couple million? Yeah. And it's a very different progress.
Yeah.
Where they are similar is that they both are able to intuit how to sell back to the state or the government, their respective governments, what the government's interests are or what they should be, particularly in relation to, you know, various threat narratives or, you know, the threat of jihadism or
right.
the, or
casualties. Like, I mean,
yes.
Prince
yeah.
is
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Big appeal was, hey, you know, my guy's dying. It doesn't go on the books for GIs dying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll get to that as well. But that was sort of the big, very comparable to Syria. Right, for the Russian state. I mean, it wasn't, Syria wasn't a covert intervention. It was as overt as they come. They didn't care about, I mean, if the Russian Ministry of Defense formally intervenes, like, no one cares about Wagner's, you know, plausible deniability. It's a question of, well, it's a question of plausible deniability to the audience back home in the sense of keeping the political costs relatively low, because there aren't official Russians coming home in zinc coffins in the Russian context. But
if I'm not mistaken, the Afghanistan war, more contractors among Americans, more contractors died than actual servicemen.
Yes. And so the Russians, they pick up on up on that. They're watching what is happening in the war on terror. In the Bush years, really pushes the privatization of warfare into overdrive. Mm-hmm. As John mentioned, I mean, the not only the casualty figures, but also the big benefit is really that the war on terror could not have been fought in the way the Bush administration and even future administrations wanted without the use of contractors, because if, as had been practiced previously, the military filled the role of all the logistics, all of the security provision that it had traditionally done during, like, World War II, you would have needed a civilian draft to do it. And so the reality is that contractors are also beneficial, because not only do they lower the body count of casualties of U.S. soldiers, but they also reduce the need for the buy-in of the public for going to war, which a military draft kind of necessarily entails, right? And so,
right, no, that's a great point, because you would by drafting, you would have a massive bureaucracy and a massive bunch of people on your government payroll. Whereas with the private contractors, they can be hired and then downsized and hired and downsized. And it's,
And I mean, also importantly, when there's a civilian draft, you know, people have a very different view of the, you know, whether or not the United States should be at war.
Yes.
You know, if we look at, you know, there were large numbers that were, especially during the surges in Iraq in the 2000s, but, you know, 100,000 was, you know, present in Iraq or fighting in the war on terror at any given point. It's a very small percent of the U.S. population. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was largely made up of people who kind of sort of were from families that have always kind of served. And so it really, it did not draw in the population as much. And it makes it easier for the U.S. government to intervene abroad without a public that, you know, feels kind of significantly affected. And, yeah. And the Russians recognize this as well. And the Russians are going through kind of similar similar circumstances where they are making an effort to transition from the old Soviet system of mass conscription, whereby every Russian male serves for 2 years. Obviously, if you're, you know, rich and connected, you can get out of it like like elsewhere in the world. But they're looking to emulate Western militaries, which had transition to, you know, what we would call a contract force, where they recruit soldiers who sign a contract with the U.S. military, and there's no draft. Mm-hmm. And what that meant in a similar circumstance was that all of those other jobs that were kind of serviced by these conscripts all of a sudden need to be serviced by private companies, and that's where Yevgeny Prigozhin comes in and particularly mm-hmm. thrives. But there's a difference which is sort of specific, a little bit more specific to Russia, which is that, you know, especially Russia at that time, it's a country, especially under Vladimir Putin, that is becoming more and more ambitious on the world stage, but still has relatively modest capacity and resources to do so and to achieve those ambitions. And so this leaves a lot of room for rich individuals, rich connected individuals, to kind of fill the gaps, right? And provide some of the funding for these patriotic initiatives. It's a way of, you know, for lack of a better term, virtue signaling, right? Or you know, mm-hmm. donating to a political party in the hopes that, you know, you're not going to recoup those costs directly, but, you know, think of me when the next time, you know, the choice contract comes around, yeah. right? Yeah. And so this is a Russian version of that. And this sort of takes us to Wagner's birth, as you well, and what brings Yevgeny Prigozhin and Dmitry Utkin together in Donbass and Ukraine in 2014.
Mm-hmm. But just before then, that they get together, there is another somewhat
another
competitive
group.
Yeah, group. Is it Redut, I think? And it's backed by Gennady Timchenko, the kind of the oil trading
so,
oligarch. Is that right?
The first guys that came out, you're right, were there were, and this really starts happening during, there's all sorts of like little kind of precursors,
right,
to what Wagner became. There were, and you know, again, similar to the U.S., there's a lot of guys who are coming out of the Russian military at any given point. A lot of them, you know, are, you know, this is kind of what they're good at. This is what they want to do. In the 90s, we saw kind of the formation of some of these private security companies
exactly.
for oligarchs and things along those
and
lines.
Some of these other ones.
Yeah. But mercenarism itself is illegal in Russia.
Right.
Again, probably a product of the 90s, where you know, oligarchs were fighting it out on the street, and there was actual concern that you know, a force could build itself up domestically that could be a threat.
I seem to remember Hodorkovsky's sort of Yukos Menetep private security force was estimated, if I remember right, to be roughly 20,000 strong. Mm-hmm. And so the first guy that they took down, I can't remember his name now off the top of his head. I don't even know if he's still in jail, but he was the head of the security. And then they went after Platon Lebedev, the mm-hmm. other billionaire. But yeah, the mm-hmm. first guy they went after was that.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's sort of, that's on the domestic scene, this sort of kind of trend. And then at the same time, you have these security entrepreneurs who are, especially in the 2000s, looking to sort of emulate the Blackwaters of the world. And they set up what, you know, basically private military companies. They skirt around the law by registering, you know, in outside territories, you know, Malta or, you know, all of the usual places that you register a shell company, and they contract with the client protecting a ship or, you know, a facility or something abroad. And the client, when the contractors show up, the client then provides the weapons needed for the task. They hand them back over, and then they return to Russia, and they would just, and this was kind of always the joke, they, you know, just come in, and when they ask, you know, what they were up to abroad at the border, they say they were tourism, right? Mm. And they would fly through a third country always. So, you know, they'd take the St. Petersburg to London flight and then go from London, you know, down to Africa or what have you. And a number of these guys actually had contracts in Iraq during Iraq War. And a lot of them really got, were doing a decent business during, if you remember, the Somali piracy crisis, which mm-hmm. was around like 2010s or so, 11.
Yeah.
And so they got contracts also with Russian ships that have to pass through.
Oh, so everybody was making money on that. I knew a New Zealand sort of part-time mercenary who got a contract just, and he said it was really easy. You just sit on the ship for a while with a machine gun next to you and, you know, soak mm-hmm. up the sun.
Yeah, and these guys, you know, they form kind of like a social network of people. And one of these groups that's doing a lot of that kind of shipping protection is called Moran Group.
Right.
And an executive at Moran, you know, these guys are always out there drumming up business. Mm-hmm. He decides to contract with the Syrians, and he contracts with a specific Syrian oligarch. Oligarchs, the Jaber brothers.
Yeah.
Oh, the Jaber brothers. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And, you know, these guys are Alawites, mm-hmm. well connected to the Assad regime. You know, they ink a deal, and they recruit sort of two units. One is just a bunch of Cossacks from various Cossack organizations. And then the other is a group that will be led by a guy, Dmitry Utkin, who had recently joined Moran and was a former GRU, Russian military intelligence officer, but fought in Chechnya, spent a lot of time then on the border with Estonia, and he was to lead the other group. And so In the new entity is called Slavonic Corps,
right? Slavonic,
and Utkin and the 200 other guys touched down in Syria in, I want to say, August 2013, if I remember correctly. It's right around the time that Assad uses chemical weapons
the Ghouta
in eastern
attack,
right? Exactly. Yeah. It's right around the Ghouta attack. and these guys touch down, and at least the guys that they recruited think that the whole deal, they're hanging out on the beach in Latakia, so they're, you know, probably living what they thought was the good life in the Gulf of Aden. Yeah. And they think that they're just there to protect some oil assets, right? Some oil fields and stuff. And then the Syrians show up and they start giving them heavy equipment and saying, you know, we're heading to Deir Ezzor, which is far in the northeast of Syria. And the guys are a little bit baffled because they're like, wait, what? Like, are we taking oil assets from ISIS? Like, we're actually fighting.
It's Islamic State territory at the time.
It's Islamic State territory. Yeah. And a couple of guys are like, this isn't what we signed up for. And then Gusev, who's kind of the leader in Moran Group, it says, you know, well, then I'm not paying you. So then everybody, you know, sucks it up. And they, instead of using the Syrian tanks, which are too old, they outfit, you know, a bunch of, you know, they make a bunch of technicals out of Toyotas and other pickups that are there, and they head off to Deir Ezzor. And sure enough, you know, they fall into an ambush. And Utkin actually manages to get everybody out alive.
Right. In the middle of a sandstorm, they just hold hands. Right?
Well, they lucked out.
The sandstorm saves them.
The sandstorm saves them.
They must have found religion after that, man. I mean,
you would think. I mean, it sounded like it for all. I mean, I talked to one guy in Slavonic Corps for the book, and it sounds like it was pretty hairy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the sandstorm saves them. Utkin gets them out. But, you know, the whole thing is a disaster. They head back to Russia, where they're all arrested by the FSB and questioned. The two leaders of the group, not Utkin, but the two kind of guys from Moran Group who had organized everything, actually end up being charged with the law against mercenarism and are sentenced to a few years in prison.
Wow.
But all the other guys who were under them, they said, you know, okay, you know, they won't get charged. This is late 2013. So this is around the same time that things are really starting to kick off in Ukraine, in Maidan. And, you know, we can go into the whole kind of beginning of the war in Donbas, but, after there's a revolution in Ukraine, the Kremlin decides to seize and then annex Crimea, and they bring in a lot of kind of Cossacks and volunteers.
Sorry, but I had a question about the Cossacks. Did they fight well? Because I remember when we were in the exile in Moscow, it's like Cossack military formations didn't have a good reputation.
I remember going down from one trip or something and hanging out with some old Cossacks, not the best shape, these guys. And this is down in the Rostov region, I think, in the Kuban. And I, an American Jew, drank them under the table. I'm not a big drinker. Wow. I don't drink anymore. And I thought, you guys are done, man. If that, like, you should pack it up right now.
Yeah.
That's bad. But are they good fighters? Because they appear a lot in your book, and they seems like some of them are quite fearsome.
I think it runs the gamut. I think for the most part, you're right. That, you know, a lot of the movement, the Cossack movement. I mean, these were guys that did not do too well under the Soviets,
yes,
and were very much kind of looking in the 90s. You know, as there's this sort of, especially during Perestroika, as there's this sort of kind of movement towards nationalism in the Soviet Union. I think, you know, there's a lot of focus always on, you know, the various Soviet republics who then break away or, you know, the Chechens. But there is also at the same time a Russian nationalist movement, mm-hmm. right? And that is also kind of coming together and starting to define itself. And within that too, there are the Cossacks who, you know, in Tsarist times had been sort of the border enforcers, runaway serfs who kind of have this cultural, you know, certainly cultural traits that you know, comes down from Russian literature and how they define themselves and the society defines them, but as sort of these very kind of like rugged, freedom-loving, escaped serfs who enforce the Tsar's borders and aid in the conquest in exchange for sort of a preferred or privileged sort of position compared to the other serfs. And so perhaps, you know, unsurprisingly, amidst all of these kind of new nationalist movements that are gaining momentum at the end of the Soviet Union, there are these Cossacks too who are looking to re-engage with their past or kind of like reimagine it and try to kind of create this new position for themselves again. And like a lot of, you know, sort of the creation of nationalisms, right? There's a lot of like LARPing that's going on too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
entrepreneurialism.
Yeah, right? I mean, and, like in Tolstoy's novel, The Cossacks, I mean, they fight one-on-one with the Chechens, and I don't think it sounds like they would be up to that today.
No.
And again, so yeah, it runs from guys who sign up for military service to guys who, you know, on the weekends like to get hammered and, you know, put on, you know, put on the outfits, right?
Yes,
And so, but, you know, these are the kind of guys who were showing up to a place like Crimea, right? When you know, there needs to be, when there's some sort of kind of nationalist call, right? And so these guys are showing up, all other volunteers are showing up, and they provide, you know, an air of, you know, kind of like a local kind of air to everything that's going on. They do some kind of intimidation and, you know, help ensure that, you know, everything goes smoothly and that the referendum comes through.
We're talking about Crimea right now.
Where they request annexation. And so, you know, the Kremlin successfully annexes Crimea, and they kind of think that they're, you know, this is done and dusted. But amidst the revolution in Ukraine, there is sort of what became known as the Maidan Revolution. There is also an anti-Maidan movement, particularly in eastern Ukraine, in a kind of a coal-producing region called the Donbas. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is an area where there's a stronger identity, but also more importantly, you know, stronger economic ties as well with right. Russia itself. And folks there see that there's a that the Russian state has come to the aid of the people in Crimea. And as they're taking over administrative buildings, just as the pro Maidan movement is taking over administrative buildings in other parts of Ukraine, they expect the Russian state to come to their aid as well. But the Russian state does not want to, at least not initially. And there was very little interest in annexing more territory than Crimea. They wanted this to be kind of a one and done, and, you know, not have to deal with further sanctions, further international isolation at the time. But Putin also was put in kind of, he was between a rock and a hard place too, because only 2 years earlier, he's trying to return to the presidency after letting his prime minister Dmitry Medvedev take the role for 4 years, and there were massive protests against this from Russians on all across the political spectrum, from liberals like Navalny to hardcore right wing Russian nationalists. And it's the latter, when Putin comes back to power, that he fears the most, because you know, those are the types of people who can get some sympathy within security services, for example. Mm. And so he's put in a bind, right? The annexation of Crimea gives him a big boost at home among Russians, in particular nationalists. But he doesn't want to intervene and risk full scale war at that time with Ukraine. But he can't be seen among the Russian public as letting these pro-Russian separatists kind of be hung out to dry, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Kremlin starts turning, not through some grand strategy, but trying to figure out ways, how do we support these guys without supporting them, right? Mm. And so they start letting those volunteers go through, the guys who are in Crimea and elsewhere, who are answering the separatist call, which is well public, you know, well covered in Russian media, mind you. Mm. And they start turning towards, you know, the use of other kind of non-state forces, and the idea comes together to bring mercenaries in, but they need sponsors for this as well, right? And so Yevgeny Prigozhin, he jumps at the chance. He's around in Donbass sniffing around, how can I scoop up assets, and he's connected with Dmitry Utkin, who just recently avoided a brush with the FSB and the Russian law, and Prigozhin sponsors and provides political coverage for Utkin, who recruits and provides a small mercenary force to go support the pro-Russian separatists in Luhansk, and the guys that Utkin initially recruits are those same guys who had all avoided getting arrested by the FSB a few months beforehand in Slavonic Corps.
Mm-hmm. So let's back up a little bit here, a little bit more background on Dmitry Utkin, because he's kind of a scary character, kind of scary looking, whereas Prigozhin, there's something almost part comical and tragic about. I mean, John compared him to Rodney Dangerfield, you know, and it actually really works the more you get to know his story, the no respect to Rodney Dangerfield. Mm-hmm. But Utkin has got this very kind of, I don't know, he looks like a character out of Wolfenstein. And
I recall, you said he decided on the name for the group, like Wagner, my favorite composer, just coincidentally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. So I mean, Utkin is a guy. Yeah, he's a scary guy. He's a he considers himself a career soldier. He had any number of wives. Who knows how many? And various girlfriends. And he also is a neo-Nazi and has SS tattoos and chooses as his call sign Wagner, as you mentioned, John, because that's his favorite composer, and it's probably his favorite composer because it was also the Nazi's favorite composer. Mm-hmm. And so, it's interesting that, or I mean, it speaks to kind of Prigozhin's kind of ability to or lack of scruple when it comes to working with people, that Prigozhin himself is of Jewish descent. Mm-hmm. And neither of these men really kind of felt like this prevented them from working together to try and make money.
Yeah, it's just business. Shortly before this, I believe, is when the Internet Research Agency that is founded by Prigozhin, the Troll Factory, that got so much coverage, I think way blown out of proportion. But it was I hadn't read about it in so long. It was such a big deal back when I was writing for Pando, I remember. And it was initially reported when this story first broke. It was Russian reporters that first broke it in Petersburg. But the way it was reported was like the internet all these years has been this idyllic garden and marketplace of ideas and this sort of pure Jeffersonian place where we didn't really have people paid to manipulate, you know, comments or whatever. And then these Russians came along, but which is obviously ridiculous. But what's kind of interesting about what I find actually really fascinating is we know so much. Like, we know that these exist mostly for purely commercial reasons, not necessarily to try to manipulate elections, but, you know, but also to get involved in politics just for commercial reasons.
And this also goes back to, again, why I think it's so important in this story to center Prigozhin as someone who is obviously vicious and cutthroat, but also very astute and can very, I would say, forward-thinking or creative. Yes. In terms of how can I connect these various kind of disparate businesses and bring them together in a synergistic way. And yes. So the troll farms, which became very famous for election interference in 2016 in the U.S., I mean, and again, I'm right there with you in terms of, you know, what they actually did and kind of what the operation was. I think, you know, the troll farms initially came out of, as you mentioned, like an effort to sort of control the information environment, especially around products. And so Prigozhin had this troll farm that was like, you know, writing reviews and like writing good things about his companies. And, you know, because he's politically astute, they also write bad things about like Navalny, right? Mm-hmm. So he can show the Kremlin what a good guy he is. Mm-hmm. And this is where the Internet Research Agency is born. And, you know, I wouldn't, you know, whether it was directed or not, and maybe it was, I think it's likely that Prigozhin was kind of funding this sort of efforts, social media efforts, and I mean, this, I couldn't put this in the book, but because I only found out about it later, but one of my sources was good friends with a guy, Igor Mangushev, who shows up in the book. And mm-hmm. Igor Mangushev, you know, had another just crazy character, a guy who, I mean, is kind of crazy. And he, like, literally. But, you know, he had, like, started his own kind of, like, he first started doing stuff in, like, the anti-migrant Russia scene. And right. And then he joins up with Prigozhin, and he works at the Internet Research Agency for a little while. And what he told my source was that we never thought that we were actually like going to affect anything. The goal was to just like let them think that.
Mm.
Right? And so the goal was the reaction, right?
Right.
Not the actual, no one thought that they were actually going to change what Americans thought about Hillary Clinton, but what they were doing was creating this image that they were incredibly powerful, and that the reaction to it would actually be far more chaotic than the chaos that they were creating. Right?
So it really
seems very effective. Yeah. I mean,
yeah, and in that sense,
if you look
kudos,
at Hillary's
right?
partisans, even now they. They still blame Russia for absolutely everything.
And Trump blames, you know, all of his ills on Russiagate, and there's truth to that. And he's very vengeful about that. Yeah, I mean, it did sow chaos. It did polarize.
It did. It did. I think it was far more successful than they could have imagined because, I mean, and I go into it a little bit in the book. I mean, what did they achieve? They got like, you know, some like, I mean, now it would be kind of, when we look back on it, it's a little bit laughable, right? Like they get, you know, they set up a couple of, you know, fake accounts with bad English that get like some retweets and stuff. Yeah. And, you know, they get like, they manage to get like maybe a few people to like hold up signs outside the White House that they pay through. Yeah. You know, it was really nothing. It was really nothing. And, you know, the far more kind of damaging stuff was the GRU doing its hacking activity. But Prigozhin, you know, he sees this as, you know, a chance to score political points back home, right? And so you fund it, doesn't cost too much, and these guys, you know, do what they do, and the reaction is a huge payoff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's got these guys working for him as well, and he's looking for, you know, all sorts of ways, right, that he can show his value to the Kremlin. And the other way that you're able to do that is by sponsoring, say, people to go support the separatists in eastern Ukraine. And so that's what he does. And Utkin and his guys enter the conflict. They play a role in the seizure of Luhansk Airport.
Right.
They provide support in Luhansk, and then, you know, as the Russians are really starting to try to get towards a more serious ceasefire, what would become Minsk II, they start doing something very different, which is basically assassinating the wayward pro-Russian separatist leaders who are against the ceasefire. Lots of guys with, you know, great names like Russian militia leaders like Batman, you know, they start...
Motorola, I remember that.
Motorola, yeah. They all start kind of dying in spectacular and mysterious circumstances. You know, blamed on the Ukrainian sabotage units, but everybody knows that it's actually Wagner itself that's doing it. And we have... they might not have done
it would be
single one
easy
of those,
duty,
but,
I would think, compared to combat. You know, it's just
it's just old school. You know,
yeah.
Car, you know, stop the car in a road along the countryside and just spray it, right? And that's what was going on. One of the Cossack leaders, his a car bomb went off when he was driving to his own wedding at the time too. I mean, yeah, these guys were all getting taken out as the Russian state decided that they wanted a ceasefire and that they would bring these territories under the state's control. And right. that the militia leaders, the initial people who were kind of leading the movement and became, you know, racketeers themselves, were slowly killed off.
Right. Right, because the people who became the separatist leaders in the pro-Russian side, it wasn't from the kind of the official like Yanukovych party elites. It was these kind of entrepreneurs who had one foot in the criminal world and one foot in, I don't know, the street or
well, you know, all kinds of places. Yeah. Like if you really want a gaudy story of a volunteer, look up Russell Bentley, aka Texas.
Yes.
Because he was wild, and he's in there in the ruins of some destroyed village, firing away, and next to him is some Italian anarchist.
yeah, there were some crazy characters. I remember Alec Loon at The Guardian wrote, he spent some time out there and wrote up, there was for a while a kind of, sort of, anarchist nationalist. I'm not really sure how it all crossed over, but they were hoping to kind of turn it leftward, and that did not last very long. But they had some power for a brief time, but that's not where the political winds were going in the Donbass.
No, yeah. No. Yeah. 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 No, but But, you know, once kind of that stuff is all dusted up and the state is looking to take control, there really isn't a role for Prigozhin's guys there anymore, or Utkin. And so, you know, most of those volunteers, a lot of those volunteers who I detail in the book too and spoke to on the Russian side, actually, and in a lot of cases were anti-Putinist. And so they were pissed when the Russian state is showing up, because, you know, that to them is not what they were fighting for. They were fighting for, you know, Russian nationalism, or, you know, some sort of ethnic Russian state. And so they clear out as well. Or right. The empire, too.
Like I talk, Dierkin, yeah, the RAM.
Yeah. And I talked a lot to Stanislav Vorobyov, who's a the leader of the Russian imperial movement. He's a friend of Dierkin. Mm-hmm. And so they're either kicked out or choose to leave. And, you know, it just so happens, or, you know, Prigozhin has a bit of luck that relatively quickly, you know, just a few months after Minsk II is signed in the summer of 2015, Russia, that fall, overtly, as we mentioned, intervenes in the conflict in Syria.
Real quickly, at what point do we know, does their PMC, or, you know, whatever their companies that register Concordia, they have all these different companies, but at what point does Wagner PMC become officially sort of into existence? Or do we know?
To be super technical, like never, because there's never really an actual entity called Wagner.
Right.
And it's all different shell companies using different, but you know, Utkin's call sign Wagner in Donbass becomes sort of the catch-all term outside of Wagner, at least initially. And for people in who are the mercenaries, they just call it the company.
Mm.
And where Wagner kind of becomes like the company, or starts kind of really acting kind of in a where it comes into its own, maybe we should say, it is in Syria. At least initially, you know, they show up at the end of 2015, early 2016, and like no one really knows what to do with them. You know, Prigozhin, again, he's always lobbying to get his guys in the fight, right? Because it benefits him monetarily and politically. They come in. They don't really, the Ministry of Defense, the MOD, doesn't really know what to do with them. They do some training. They do a little bit of maybe contact with the rebels, but a missile hits them and a bunch of guys are killed, and the MOD panics and sends them back. And relatively shortly thereafter, it becomes very clear that, you know, what Russia wanted to be was largely an anti-ISIS campaign, and largely keep it as an air campaign. You know, Assad also wanted it to be an anti-rebel campaign in general. Mm-hmm. And it also became very clear that the forces under Assad's control were not like the most motivated people in the world, because you can imagine Assad's management style.
Mm-hmm.
And so it becomes clear that Russian air power alone will not retake territory from the rebels. And so Wagner gets itself back into the conflict. And in 2017, they log a big victory, taking Palmyra from ISIS. And the MOD says...
Yeah, I remember that campaign.
Yeah.
And it really seemed as if nothing could stop ISIS at that point. And I remember they were kidnapping and killing archaeologists. There was one heroic Syrian archaeologist who absolutely refused to tell them where he'd hidden some of the most valuable relics. And they chopped his head off, of course. And that was when Wagner to me at least, it was like, go Wagner. I mean, yeah. No penalty for killing Islamic State guys.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what, and their role, I think it'll be surprising to some people to read that they played a role in that campaign and the mm-hmm. role that they actually did play, because obviously in the West, we like to focus on kind of our own role in the and there's a lot of effort to basically say that the Russians were only there to, you know, that they weren't fighting against ISIS is something yes. you often hear. And I think that this book kind of disproves it with these guys' stories. And I mean, and also just the undeniable things that they took first Palmyra, and they get, you know, they get sent back home after that. The MOD's, you know, again says, you know, thanks for everything. We'll take it from here, which is mostly the credit. And, and so they go back home. As we know, Assad and the Iranians now want them to, the Russians want to keep going further against ISIS, because one of the main motivations for Russia kind of joining or intervening in Syria is that they, you know, this is right off the bat of Crimea. They're isolated on the world stage. There are sanctions. And Putin thinks that he can kind of force the U.S. into like a joint counterterrorism operation, you know, and basically force open lines of communication again by being the other, you know, big power that's present there in Syria.
Right.
And to a certain extent, they do. But I mean, I think the U.S. was like didn't react maybe as the Russians thought right. that they would.
I think we're seeing that now. The U.S. has gone totally silent.
Yeah. Wasn't another reason as well. I don't know where the Caucasus insurgencies are by 2017, but certainly earlier
ISIS
they were
big.
ISIS
is a real issue for Russia too, in that a lot of Russian speakers out of the former Soviet Union are joining, Chechens, people from the Caucasus, you know, people who are from Central Asia and radicalized in Russia and then go. And so that is also, you know, something that's very disconcerting. The Iranians and Assad want them just to focus on, you know, rebels in Aleppo. And they managed to get the Russians to do so. And, as a result of that, ISIS has an opportunity to retake Palmyra.
Right.
And so Prigozhin, you know, again, has his chance to get his guys back into the fight. But this time around, he's looking to kind of create more touch points than just, you know, the MOD. And so he signs a deal with the Assad government that they will kind of to retake territory on behalf of the Syrian government, and in exchange for 25% of the proceeds of the oil and gas assets that are returned to the state. And so Wagner is back, a few thousand guys this time, and they launch their campaign against ISIS.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad with your book you make the whole attack on the Conoco oil fields and the Russian state's response to it. It's all very clear in your book. It's really insane, that whole battle between Wagner basically going after a vulnerable, but still it's the U.S., you know, a vulnerable American military point, American/Kurdish, and just getting, it was really stupid too, like, and getting pasted and almost sparking potential war, which, yeah, was not, Putin's idea there. So I would have thought Putin would have had, Putin would have thought, well, this could be pretty dangerous when they're not directly under the MOD like this. What's the fallout from the battle of when Wagner attacks American forces and tries to take this oil field? Like, what's the fallout? Is this where it transitions to Africa? And we definitely need to get to Africa.
That's an interesting question. And like, we don't know for sure. But I think what I would say is that I don't think it was as big of a deal at that time. Prigozhin took a gamble. These guys are mercenaries. Like, there's going to be losses, right? And the gamble didn't work. The Americans didn't back away.
Right.
They did the opposite. He was probably pissed. You know, Shoigu was pissed. They looked bad.
Yeah.
But, you know, they continue to work together in Africa. And so Africa, a little bit before, there are some guys who show up to Prigozhin and talk to him about opportunities in Sudan to mine for gold. He's interested. He sends his guys over there to do some feasibility studies. And they ink a deal to provide military training to Bashir's forces in Sudan, and in exchange they get access to some mining concessions. And so Prigozhin first is touching down in Africa in 2017, right before the big battle of Hisham in Syria. And, you know, if anything, what happened in Syria sort of showed, you know, not necessarily the end of cooperation with the Russian MOD or anything, but the end of opportunity in Syria itself. The line of contact between the Kurdish-backed SDF and pro-Assad forces is pretty settled there along the Euphrates.
Right.
They tried it once. It didn't work, to put it lightly. Right. And so there's not much else that can be done. But luckily, Prigozhin is a guy who's got, you know, always, you know, part of this is a commercial enterprise, right? And, you know, commercial enterprises have business development. And so he's got guys going out now all over. They land a deal in Sudan, and while they're over there, a representative from the Central African Republic asked them if they would be interested in something similar. And so Prigozhin, you know, is interested. He sends some guys to do a feasibility study. And pretty soon thereafter, they ink a deal with the Central African government to provide military trainers in exchange for mineral concessions in late 2017. And they first start touching down in 2018 as well. Prigozhin's got other guys who are like political consultants coming out of, you know, the St. Petersburg
Internet
scene.
Research agency, the troll farm.
And they're showing up in Madagascar to you know, like provide advice on the elections, and they don't know a single thing about the country. And I mean, there's a lot of like bumbling through, I hope, that comes through in the book as well. And a lot of figuring things out as they go too.
But I have to say, at times they came off a lot more impressive than I expected.
Right.
Well, particularly in the Sahel, like this, you describe this amazing scene where after Wagner, Prigozhin inked this deal to start operating in the car in the Central African Republic, to get to know who the players are, basically, because there are rebel groups all over this, you know, fragmented country. They just load up a convoy, an armored convoy, and drive from Sudan into the car to Bangui, and they wind up meeting a lot of people that and establishing relationships and respect, which is really important in these situations. Like, they, you know, you're either going to get killed or you're going to get some respect and some good relationships going. And it, I thought that was really pretty brilliant. And they did have some diplomatic successes for a while, which...
Well, if I could read a passage from John's book, in Niger, they take advantage of the heavy-handed and just plain rude behavior of other powers. Like, Niger's prime minister stated that U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Molly Fee, urged him to refrain from engaging with Iran and Russia. And then the prime minister says, "When she finished, I said, 'Madame, I am going to summarize in 2 points what you have said. First, you have come here to threaten us in our country. That is unacceptable. And you have come here to tell us with whom we can have relationships, which is also unacceptable. And you have done it all with a condescending tone and a lack of respect.'" So, they must have looked good compared to the French who had sort of worn out their welcome across the Sahel and the Americans.
Yeah, and I mean, they weren't showing up with, you know, PhDs in African studies by by any stretch. I mean, Prigozhin found some of them, some of the academics who, you know, would just become, you know, what academics do. They go on a little trip and they get to do some free research and then they, you know, provide a report about, you know, the interactions between the Fulani and, you know, local, you know, farming communities or what have you. But, you know, especially in those early years, he's very focused on, okay, I have to meet all of the actors in any given place. And so, and they have the benefit of not being the French, which comes with a lot of colonial and post-colonial colonial baggage. And they're creative. That was one of my favorite things to write in the book because no one had reported on Wagner's role in brokering an internationally accepted peace agreement with like UN approval. Yeah. It was a great scene, multiple scenes as these guys are going about it. And so, you know, they'll do anything, right, that they think will give them an advantage or something that might work. And is something that they can deliver as a victory because Prigozhin, when he's getting to Africa, right, Syria and Ukraine, which we were discussing, those have clear like Russian national interests, right? And we know that they have interests because there are plenty of other Russian institutions that are there on the ground, right? It's not just Prigozhin and his guys. It's the MOD, it's the GRU, the SVR, the FSB is all over there, right? Mm-hmm. Once you get to a place like the Central African Republic, there isn't the Russian state doesn't have a presence there. There's a ragtag like little embassy. There's not even like a military attaché. And so when Prigozhin shows up there, he is the state. He is the Russian state. Doesn't mean that he can control everything that's going on in the Central African Republic. It's a complex country in conflict. But it means that he has license and he doesn't have as many of those checks against him from other security institutions and other Russian, you know, connected people to just go off and do whatever he thinks he can pull off. And so they do a peace agreement. These guys eventually start getting involved in like breweries and like vodka distilleries and timber, you know, whatever he thinks is, you know, has a shot. They have radio stations, right? He's always thinking about soft power too.
Yeah.
And there's that great quote in there where someone who knew him has said that he loved to read Gramsci, which is like such a funny.
I saw like, that. I was like, is that for serious? I
mean, yeah, like he was a big, he was. But he was reading it more as like a how-to, you know, like, it's like, I like how to achieve cultural hegemony. and so, you know, I'm sure Gramsci would have been rolling in his grave if he found out Prigozhin was going around, you know.
Engineering Gramsci.
Yeah, it's like, Yeah, we can be the monsters in this, half birth. He's got all of these initiatives that he's always doing, which I think he sees as all complementary to each other. But the support, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? Because the less interested the Russian state is in a place like the Central African Republic, the more he is able to go about and do his own thing, but also the less likely are, you know, state subsidies going to be coming in for him as well. And so there's also a serious effort to try and make these things not just self-financing over time, but, you know, hopefully profitable in the long term. And so there's a lot of interest in gold. There's initially some interest in diamonds, but they quickly kind of figure out that that's not going to work. And so that kind of explains why they were kind of expanding into all of these areas as well.
Mm. Yeah, I strongly recommend people read the book because your Africa chapters are great. And using Wagner and Prigozhin and some of these people as a thread, you can, in a way, kind of better understand these very complex wars and fractures in these Sahelian societies, and what happened to the French, you know, how the French Empire there, or the kind of post-empire imperial presence there, just, God, it just dissolved, you know, and so the timing was great for Prigozhin and Russia. And, you know, the Russians, I have to say, they were pretty, like, they held that big summit in Sochi in 2019, but they had those old relationships with all these African countries from the old Soviet days. And they kind of, they took them a lot more seriously after Putin took power. And, you know, and they were clashing more with the West. They took them a lot more seriously, and it's paid off, I think, for them diplomatically and otherwise. But, you know, there's always a question of how long, Africa Corps, just Russia's kind of diplomatic wins that they've had in the Sahel, how long that'll last, how deep it goes. But that's for another story. I want to move on because we've kept you so long, and I don't want to leave without talking about the war in Ukraine and how Wagner just really comes to its own and you know, explodes as a force. You reminded, you know, that where they first really made their name in that war, they weren't even in it in the beginning. It was, mm-hmm. it was, right, it was Redoute. Was the first one, and they got creamed, it sounds like. And then Wagner actually performed well. I remember the Battle of Popasna. That was a very important and bloody battle. And so they kind of, again, he's always kind of proving himself, Prigozhin. But
he
then,
always
of
has
course,
to. He always yeah, always has that's the to. Issue. That's his issue. And that's what he's ultimately trying to overcome, is to be in that position with, like, you know, like Timchenko, right? The guy we mentioned who just got a bunch of assets in Syria for doing nothing. That's the whole point. He doesn't have to do anything, right? Yeah. He's Putin's good buddy from way back when. He just gets stuff, right? Prigozhin is never in a position where he's just given anything. He always has to work harder, prove himself, you know, better than the next person over. And so, like you said, the MOD, they don't love him for a host of reasons. And so they try to keep him out of the war in the beginning, and they think it's going to be a relatively quick deal anyways, that Zelensky's unpopular, he's going to be overthrown quickly, and then, you know, everything is, you know, the special operation, as military operation, as they call it, is over. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that doesn't happen. And eventually they have to bring in more men, and they need the talent that Wagner commanders and people who have fought for Wagner bring to bear. Because these are some of the only guys who have had significant experience getting shot at in the, you know, since the war with Georgia that was five days, right? And so, like you said, these guys come in, they get some early victories, they get Popasna, and Prigozhin's star is rising, right? And his ego is rising even quicker than his star is rising with the Kremlin, and he starts promising more and more victories, and he needs more and more resources. Billboards start going up across the country to fight for Wagner. He now officially claims that he's the founder of Wagner. He's on Russian TV all day long. And so he's really kind of coming into his own. He's really self-actualizing, I guess we will say.
Right.
And so he promises Bakhmut, and in order to do it, in order to take Bakhmut from the Ukrainians, and previously, he receives the wink and the nod to go and recruit from Russia's prisons to bring in more men. And so he you know, really personally goes and visits basically all of the prisons.
Yeah.
And he gives the he brings everyone into the yard in each of these places, and he reads them the deal, which is you fight for me for 6 months, and if you survive, your criminal record is expunged. You get paid $2,000 a month.
That had to be a better deal than a long sentence yes. in a Russian prison.
Yeah, God. I've been to a Russian prison in Siberia. Yeah. It is grim.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed a number of these guys. There's endlessly fascinating things about these guys. But, you know, you get a, you know, 50,000 guys sign up. So that's no small amount. And that's a testament to the conditions there as well.
Yeah.
But I remember talking to, I had two guys in front of me. One of the guys, he had murdered someone and was sentenced to 20 years, and he had served like five. And so you kind of were like, okay, it makes like sense that you saw this as a chance, right, to take a shot.
Mm-hmm.
The other guy, he had committed an assault, and he was put away for 4 years. And I was like, oh, how long have you served, had you served of your term? And he was like, three. And I was like, so you saved yourself 6 months, like, by going to Bakhmut into, like, the meat grinder? And he's like, yeah, I didn't think much about it, you know, just signed up.
Wow.
The best
and it's
way.
Like, you have to understand, like, this is the filter of the people who are showing up, right? Like,
yes.
the,
yeah.
you know, folks who might not always be the most forward-thinking. And then,
yes.
you know, to your point, not everybody in the prison system was also that, you know, they were like, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. And so, you know, it really depended, but not everybody is signing up for it either. But, you know, the deal is 6 months, you survive. Prigozhin says, my losses are worse than Stalingrad. If you desert, you're shot on sight. If you show up and you decide you don't want to do it, you're shot on sight. And 50,000 people show up. And this is how he's going to take Bakhmut from the Ukrainians. It's just by human waves. And as his, you know, ego is getting bigger and bigger, the MOD looks to check him again, starting in kind of early 2023. But he still hasn't taken Bakhmut yet. And the first thing that they do is they cut him off from, the recruiting of the prison population. They continue to do it themselves, but Prigozhin can't do it anymore.
The MOD continues to recruit. It's legalized, yeah. right? But
it's legalized, exactly.
They cut him off from it, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, Prigozhin has promised this, you know, gigantic victory. Now, the means of achieving it are being taken away from him. He also has these thousands of guys under his command, and you know, he's a narcissist. He goes on, you know, video at one point on Telegram yeah. saying, you know, some people are saying this might make me political back home. And it's like, yeah. like clearly.
And then the strange thing in your story, sorry, but
yeah, go ahead.
Is the shortage of artillery shells.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a valid objection on his part, but it completely contradicted the Western narrative, which was Russia has all the artillery shells in the universe, and Ukraine is like 2 hours from running out.
And even guys within Wagner that I've talked to go different ways about, you know, how much access to ammunition they had. Because at this point, Prigozhin is duking it out with Minister of Defense Shoigu, and he doesn't have access to Putin himself. And so he figures out the way to do it is to do it via Telegram, right? Because it's going to the entire Russian public. It creates, you know, an issue, right, that will hopefully, you know, make it back up to Putin via, you know, the chaos that he's causing.
I mean, again, the soft power experience that he got from doing this for 10 years or so, right? I mean, who would have thought it would be ultimately used in a wartime to get the leader, you know, Putin's ear and get around his sort of bureaucratic enemies in the MOD and wherever else.
Yeah, and this is where he's very good at playing, you know, the cards that he has and seeing his advantage. Shoigu and the MOD, they're like, they won't ever be cool on Telegram, right?
Right.
And they won't be able to use it to the same way that Prigozhin can use it. And so he's getting shut out. He's going to go, you know, the populist blogger, you know, the route. Yeah. And so, you know, is he politicizing populist the ammunition block. Thing? Probably. Are they getting less shells too? Probably. But are they getting, you know, less than even other Russian units? Maybe not. But this spat gets really ugly, and it starts and it's getting really public. And then the Shoigu gets the approval from the Kremlin that now all Russians fighting in Ukraine have to re-sign a contract. I mean, if they don't have one already, with the Ministry of Defense, and so they're effectively taking Prigozhin's force away from him. And as you can imagine, first of all, Prigozhin is not someone who at this point seems like he could go retire to a log cabin in Siberia and chop wood, right? And and I think he saw he recognized, as I mentioned, that the having this force underneath him made him political, right? Mm-hmm. And someone that had to be dealt with. If that is taken away, then his enemies can basically do whatever they want with him. And so, maybe he wouldn't have been killed tomorrow, but maybe he thought, 5 years down the road, it's obscurity and, eventual, demise, and that's just as bad for him.
And he just decides, go out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
Better the burnout than to rust, and he's also always one for doubling down, right? And so he decides, well,
it worked for him.
We'll make a fait accompli. We're going to turn these guys back, and the mission becomes the crossover. Wagner crosses over from Ukraine back into Russia, and they seize the Southern Military Command in June 2023. And the mission is like very simple. It's capture and kill Shoigu and Gerasimov. And the logic apparently is that by killing the Minister of Defense, Putin won't have any other choice but to name Prigozhin as Minister of Defense.
I killed the other candidate, so you think I got the inside track now?
Yeah, but it makes sense kind of in the way that, people can work in these ways, right? Which is create a fait accompli, and then the state has to support you, right? And
man, what a Shakespearean play this would make.
I know. I'm begging people to want to do the movie or the scripted TV show. But, so they get to Rostov-on-Don, and Shoigu's not there. He's fled. The generals who are there try and talk him down a little bit. That doesn't work. And he decides he's going to start his march for justice, going up the highway from Rostov to Moscow.
Yeah.
And so they start. And, they're moving up, and it's looking ever much more like there's going to be serious bloodshed in the capital. The mayor of Moscow has got, bulldozers out there and, that are, breaking up the highway to slow down their potential advance. And at kind of the 11th hour, Lukashenko, Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, manages to broker an agreement, and Prigozhin calls it off, which, was probably, at that point, that was probably the one point in his life that he, when he really, really should have doubled down.
Right.
This was the first time that he blinks. He calls it off, and, sure enough, 3 months later, his plane comes falling out of the sky. And you mentioned like the Shakespearean tragedy, but there's also the Icarian, like the Icarus.
Yeah, that's right.
The man who flew too close.
This grenade blew my wax off.
Yeah, exactly. And so, Prigozhin, 3 months later, meets his demise. And one can say that Putin did very little to disabuse everyone the Russian state was behind it, and he had his just desserts for the mutiny.
As a Canadian cop once said to me, "So a lesson learned here today."
Yeah,
no, but it was in a weird way. I think it was inevitable because he always. I just remember a lot of Russians back in the 90s and 2000s that I knew, they would quote that old Pagavorka, he who doesn't risk doesn't drink champagne. Mm. And he's such a creature of the 90s, like with just incredible mobility, which did happen up and down. And he was clever and smart and forward thinking and brutal as hell. And you know, it was the only thing he knew when things got dire, because he was either going to have to do the complete opposite of that, the smart thing when the MOD came down on him and Putin was obviously with Shoigu, would have been, yeah, to retire. And, you know, it wouldn't even have to be to a log cabin. It could have been a nice retirement in Sochi or whatever, you know.
The guys I talked to think that even during all of that shitstorm with Bakhmut and the, where's my ammunition and all of that public spat with Shoigu, like if he had just kind of like quietly, you know, like, hey, we're out of Bakhmut, you know, this is it, we're out of the war.
Yeah.
He probably could have still like found himself head of, you know, sort of like the what would become the new Africa Corps MOD operate, you know, like head of, you know, Africa.
Yeah. But it would have been less than what he had still, because with Bakhmut he had a 50,000 man military force.
It would have been a, you know, for him.
He was swinging for the fences. He was not somebody to just go for the batting average.
Exactly. Then it wouldn't have been him.
Couldn't. You know? I think he was constitutionally incapable of that.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Okay, I think this is an apt place to stop because, you know, it's Prigozhin's demise. But again, I want to urge everyone to get this book, Death is Our Business. It travels around a lot in hot spots and really goes deep into Africa, which John knows very well and spent a lot of time there. And it's very hard to find Anglosphere people who have had, you know, that sort of reporting chops. You and James Pogue are among the very few. Anyway, and then of course all the big wars of the last 10 years, 15 years. So, John, again, congratulations on your book, and thank you so much for coming on Radio Warner.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me. That was a pleasure to be here.
Great. Thanks. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.